Hello and welcome to a special WHUS Public Affairs presentation. On the bright sunny afternoon of September 8, 2002, Connecticut residents attended a peace rally in Hartford's Bushnell Park. The Hope Out Loud gathering featured numerous speakers and musicians, and even some poets, to bring forth a message in opposition to the threat of a U.S. war against Iraq. The event was sponsored by numerous local organizations, including the Connecticut Coalition for Peace and Justice and WWUH Radio Hartford. In this program, we will hear three of the speakers who attended the Hope Out Loud Peace Rally. The first speaker is Dan Jones of the September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. He lost a brother-in-law in the attack on the World Trade Center. The second speaker is Dave Iano of Veterans for Peace. He was in the Vietnam War and has fought against war ever since. And the third speaker in this program is Anne DeLeva, who teaches women's studies at the University of Connecticut and is a board member with the Connecticut chapter of the National Organization for Women. We begin with Dan Jones.
Good afternoon. My name is Dan Jones. I'm from a group called September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows is a group that was formed by people who lost family members on September 11th at the World Trade Center, at the Pentagon, and in the flight that crashed in Pennsylvania. Before I start, I just wanted to point out two pieces of literature I brought. One is a yellow flyer, it's a Peaceful Tomorrows flyer, and then the other is some quotations and some thoughts about setting up an Afghan Victims Fund, similar to the 9/11 fund that aids family members impacted by the attacks on September 11th. Two different groups of September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows members have gone to Afghanistan January and in June and have come back to report on the devastation that they've seen, that they've witnessed there as a result of the U.S.-led bombing campaign. So just as there's federal money available and private money that's been raised to aid families impacted by the attacks on September 11th, Peaceful Tomorrows and a group called Global Exchange are advocating the creation of a similar fund to aid the innocent victims of those who were impacted in Afghanistan. Both of these pieces of literature are over on the American Friends Service Committee table to my right, under the tree. It'd be a nice break from the sun once the program's done. We get our name as from a quotation from a speech by Dr. Martin Luther King. I just want to read a little excerpt from that speech. "The past is prophetic in that it asserts loudly that wars are poor chisels for carving out peaceful tomorrows. One day we must come to see that the peace is not merely a distant goal that we seek, but a means by which we arrive at that goal. We must pursue peaceful ends through peaceful means." September 11th, 2001 was a day very much like this day. It was a little bit cooler, but it was a brilliant, sunny, blue sky day. It was a day my wife was walking our kids to school and I was riding my bike to work, and for some reason I felt the need to catch up with them so we could both drop our kids off together. It was the first day of that school year that my daughter, who was then in kindergarten, went into the building without crying. And then later on that morning, it was a day that changed for all of us. For the members of Peaceful Tomorrows, September 11th, 2001, was a day of unimaginable personal loss. Each of us lost a family member at the World Trade Center, at the Pentagon, or in the crash of Flight 93 near Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Losing loved ones to those extreme acts of violence has affected us deeply. It is something from which we will never recover, not in 1 year, not in a lifetime. But in the days, weeks, and months following that terrible day of loss, we have also received incredible gifts. We gained each other because we spoke out publicly about our opposition to war and violence as a response to our personal and national tragedies. We gained the love and compassion of new friends all over the United States and all over the world. We gained the knowledge that there are thousands of Americans and millions around the globe who share our view that war is not the answer to the crimes of September 11th. The outpouring of support, compassion, and generosity our families have received has gone a long way towards filling the holes that were left in our hearts that day, and we thank you. We would not be here today without your support. We have also come to recognize our kinship with the other innocent victims of terrorism and war, a kinship that goes beyond our own borders. Among those who have reached out to us in sympathy are people who lost their own loved ones to violence throughout the world. People from Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Israel, Palestine, Afghanistan, Iran, Colombia, Ireland, and others who have experienced horrific losses. They have welcomed us into their global family, and we treasure their support. We live in the 21st century, an age when the barriers to trade and to exchange of goods, services, and ideas, and people are disappearing. This reality brings with it the urgent need for new ways of dealing with the rest of the world. We must move beyond seeking revenge and instead seek accountability for actions that foster violence. We must conquer injustice by creating a just world. We and our children and our grandchildren will live in a connected world. We can no longer afford in this country to live outside of it. In Afghanistan, thousands of innocent victims, civilians, have been affected by the bombing, and the lives of millions remain in danger from the ongoing hunger and poverty resulting from two decades of war and exacerbated by the United States military operations. Members of Peaceful Tomorrows have visited innocent Afghan families who lost loved ones to the U.S. bombing. We have campaigned for assistance to these families, believing that such assistance represents the highest ideals of America and serves to bolster our support in the region. The contemplated invasion of Iraq, a nation that has no proven links to the events of September 11th, all in the name of the war on terrorism, means that more American service people and more civilians will die, with unforeseen effects on our security, our economy, and our ability to address the root causes of terrorism and our relationship with other nations. At home, the consequences of our singular reliance on military as a response to the tragedies of 9/11 have been far-reaching. Our nation has yet to begin a meaningful, independent investigation of how and why September 11th attacks occurred, information that is crucial for protecting us from similar attacks in the future. Our domestic problems, unemployment, inadequate health care, poor schools, hunger, violence, drug abuse, continue to grow, and so does our military budget. The war on terrorism does not put reality on a hold. It is time to acknowledge that pursuing a military response in the absence of pursuing other options is an extravagantly expensive, wasteful, and limited means of action. The real work begins once the bombs stop dropping. Terrorism is portrayed as our greatest, newest problem, but it is also a symptom of rooted in other, more familiar problems. Extremism, militarism, poverty, racism, ignorance, inequality, hatred, hopelessness, and rage. We haven't done enough to address them, and until we do, they will continue to announce their presence through violence and terrorism in an increasingly desperate attempt to bring about change. September 11th changed the world for all of us. And just to end, I see there's a lot of kids in the audience here. I have three kids, and we read Harry Potter. So at the end of the fourth book, there's a re-rise of evil under the name Lord Voldemort, an evil wizard in Harry Potter. And there's a debate about what's the best way to protect the wizarding community. What's the way to protect people from that evil? Some want to use violent, ghoulish dementors to protect them. And others think that that using violence to end violence is part of the problem. It's kind of a prescient writing. But at the end of the book, the headmaster of the school addresses the student body. It is my belief, and never have I hoped, that I am mistaken more, that we are all facing a dark and difficult times. Some of you in this hall have already suffered directly at the hands of evil. Many of your families have been torn asunder. A week ago, a student was taken from our midst. A year ago, 3,000 people were taken from our midst. Remember Cedric Remember, if the time should come when you have to make a choice between what is right and what is easy, remember what happened to a boy who was good and kind and brave because he strayed across the path of evil. Remember my brother-in-law, William Kelly. Thank you.
In situations I cannot even imagine, and all I can say about him personally is that when I see him on the street, on the sidewalk, wherever he is, whether he's talking to people, whether he's carrying a sign, I just get this huge smile for Dave Iano. He's with Vets for Peace. He's a Vietnam vet, president of the Central Connecticut Veterans for Peace. He's the father of four girls, educated in the Hartford Public Schools.
Yeah.
Endorsed Green Party candidate for the new Hartford Board of Education. Dave Iano.
Good afternoon, everyone. I have a few words to say of my own, and then I'm going to read to you from some combat veterans a few short pieces. I hope you'll appreciate them. The Inuit, commonly referred to as the Eskimo, have an expression of what a community can look and act like during a time of crisis or stress. It is called being stunned by the drum. This nation, since September 11th, has been stunned by the drumbeat of fear and patriotism. A criminal act of murder was committed by deranged individuals killing themselves as they committed this deed. The fear was engendered by this horrific occurrence and is being used to whip the people of this nation into a frenzy of justifiable vengeance. There is no justice in the war on terrorism. There will only be more death and injustice. We have been sowing the teeth of the dragon for generations and are now reaping the whirlwind. I will explain how I've reached this conclusion. I spent 16 years in the United States Army. 13 of those years were as a military dependent or an Army brat, if you will. In the 1969, on graduating from Lakes High School in Washington State, I enlisted in the United States Army. I was RA all the way, regular Army. I married my high school sweetheart, also an Army brat, in March of 1970 after basic training. And then I volunteered for and went to Vietnam in July of 1970. I was primed. I was the firstborn son of a career military officer. I was an honor student and a jock. I was militarized by my own tribal culture to the point where I considered seeking a West Point appointment. I went to Vietnam as an American fighting man and came home as a human being. I was a medic in Vietnam. Men died with my hands on them. I wrote letters home to parents explaining how their sons died. I have been bringing out the dead for 32 years. I have felt what other men only write or speak of. The men presently advocating for war with Iraq and continuing the war in Afghanistan have not felt what some of the rest of us have. Our history has led us to this point, and I feel we must look at all that has occurred. I was raised on American history, and I feel we must look, and I was raised on American history that justified our actions as necessary and manifest as destiny. We were righteous always. We were not taught the examples of Bacon's Rebellion, Mad Anthony Wayne, Andersonville, Wounded Knee, or the Philippine Insurrection. The history of the Vietnam War barely mentions the My Lai Massacre and does not tell of the GIs who resisted the commands to fire on the men, women, and children. Nothing is taught about the Winter Soldier hearings before Congress in 1971, when combat veterans detailed countless atrocities and reported them to Congress. Nothing is taught about the Vietnam veterans against the war, combat veterans who resisted and demonstrated against the war, hurling their medals on the White House lawn. There is a long history of combat veterans who have fought for peace and written about the trauma of war. Siegfried Sassoon, wounded 5 times in the trenches of World War I, resigned his royal commission from the English Parliament and wrote a published letter entitled "Finished with the War." Ron Kovic, who led the last patrol at the VVAW at the Republican Convention in 1972. Leonard Matlovich, Tim O'Brien, and Steve Mason, all combat veterans who see it as their patriotic duty to resist unjust and immoral war. I put it to you, we can be patriots and resist the call to war. As Steve Mason, poet laureate of Vietnam vets, says, I am not a gentleman, I am a warrior for peace. I'm going to read to you what Siegfried Sassoon wrote. This is a soldier's declaration, finished with the war. Siegfried Sassoon was wounded 5 times in the First World War. And after the Battle of the Somme, when his best friend was killed, he crawled across no man's land at night with a knife into the trenches of the Germans and slit their throats. He became so crippled by what had happened to him that he wrote this letter in an attempt to resign his commission. I am making this statement as an act of willful defiance of military authority because I believe that the war is being deliberately prolonged by those who have the power to end it. I am a soldier, convinced that I am acting on behalf of soldiers. I believe that this war, upon which I entered as a war of defense and liberation, has now become a war of aggression and conquest. I believe that the purpose for which I and my fellow soldiers entered upon this war should have been so clearly stated as to have made it impossible to change them, and that had this been done, the objects which actuated us would now be attainable by negotiation. I have seen and endured the sufferings of the troops, and I can no longer be a party to prolong this suffering for the ends which I believe to be evil and unjust. I am not protesting against the conduct of the war, but against the political errors and insincerities for which the fighting men are being sacrificed. On behalf of those who are suffering now, I make this protest against the deception which is being practiced on them. Also, I believe that I may help to destroy the callous complacence with which the majority of those at home regard the continuance of agonies which they do not share and which they have not sufficient imagination to realize. After he wrote this statement, they sent him to be treated for shell shock at Craig Lockhart, a place termed by them Dottieville in Scotland. He did return to duty, and he wrote poetry against war for the rest of his life. Timothy O'Brien, who's a Vietnam veteran and wrote The Things That They Carried, described what a true war story is. This is the definition of a true war story. A true war story is never moral. It does not instruct nor encourage virtue nor suggest models of proper human behavior, nor restrain men from doing the things men have always done. If a story seems moral to you, do not believe it. If at the end of a war story you feel uplifted, or if you feel that some small bit of rectitude has been salvaged from the larger waste, then you have been made the victim of a very old and terrible lie. There is no rectitude whatsoever. There is no virtue. As a first rule of thumb, therefore, you can tell a true war story by its absolute and uncompromising allegiance to obscenity and evil. You can tell a true war story if it embarrasses you. If you don't care for obscenity, you don't care for the truth. And if you don't care for the truth, watch how you vote. You send guys off to war, don't be surprised when they come home talking dirty. This last piece is written by Steve Mason, also a combat veteran of Vietnam. It's called A Warrior for Peace This Time. Somewhere in the sad past of each man alone is a woman, a song, a war, which if put to music would be strings and harp, cymbals and cannon from Maestro Toscanini, orchestrating spring in each man's soul. There, seated in the balcony of each man's sense of what might have been, is the memory of a young man with sad eyes hearing no from a lover who would have made all the difference. Now, he huffs and he puffs in the middle-aged city of his choking dreams, pulling on a waistline too big for a Levi's, and sees life through the dreams of color-faded denim, sandpapered smooth as water by the truth of her absence. Tomorrow waits, a buzzard on a signpost with his name. One street over, maybe, he might have lived, who knows, forever. And why not? With a girl who fit as tight as his imagination, never got a head cold or had daughter who needed braces. And he wonders this fine day, sitting on a spiritual knoll somewhere on the bright side of Venus and the dark side of youth, just how far behind him was that promise of what might have been, and what if he'd refused to budge a galactic inch from here and now? I will wonder of war and of the sons and daughters of my enemy, whose real and separate worlds I broke, ultimately and infinitely, in the rude finality of senseless death. When we kill a dreamer, we bury alive 10,000 dreams and all his unborn children. In the age of nuclear weapons, there is not enough world to dig so deep a hole. In my sad past, when I was young, I came home from a war alone, my soul an unhung murderer. One dark night, it stepped heavily on the trapdoor of my guilt and decorously hanged itself. I pray it has found peace away from me, for I am a warrior for peace and not a gentleman. Thank you.
Is up next to speak for us. She is a teacher of women's studies at UConn, and she's a board member of the Connecticut Now. And is she here? Anna, are you up? All right, let's give a hand for Anna D'Alva. I have an image of peace that I now carry around with me to help me through hard times. It was a Tuesday morning last September. The fall semester had just started with all its usual energy and chaos. That morning, I had set the alarm extra early so that I would have time to work in my garden before the day began. I love to garden, to nurture plants in the earth, to raise vegetables and herbs to share with family and friends. It's one of the most deeply peaceful things that I do. And no matter what my troubles, I always find solace in my garden, among the tomatoes and the green beans and the basil. I remember that it was a beautiful morning, one of those days when it's hard to say whether it's late summer or early fall, when the sun is shining hard and your skin is deliciously hot, but the air is sweetly cool. I kept putting off going to the office because I knew I would be there late into the night, and I only reluctantly left at 9. That's the image of peace, of safety, contentment, growth, happiness, beauty, sharing, plenty, promise fulfilled, that I carry around with me. It is a peace that has almost entirely eluded me since that day, for that day was September 11th. And as I drove to work, I heard what I first took to be a sick radio joke, but soon realized was an attack on the World Trade Center. I sat in a parking lot at UConn and listened as the towers collapsed, crying, and crying still, I made my way to my department where colleagues and students gathered and followed the day's tragic events. People have said that the attack on the World Trade Center was like the assassination of John F. Kennedy, a watershed event in American history. There's always that question people ask when they talk about the assassination. Where were you when Kennedy died? But that, for me, is an empty question. The important question now is not where were you when the World Trade Center collapsed, but what have you done since that day? What have you done about racism, about war and violence, about poverty, about oppression in all its forms? Just having been there is not enough. In the days after the attack, I turned, as I so often do, for comfort and wisdom and hope, to the words of poet and activist Audre Lorde. In her essay, The Transformation of Silence into Language and Action, I found what I needed, for Lorde challenges us, her readers, to break our silences, as she had done when facing a life-threatening illness. Let me share some of her words with you. Audre Lorde. In becoming forcibly and essentially aware of my mortality and of what I wished and wanted for my life, however short it might be, priorities and omissions became strongly etched in a merciless light. And what I most regretted were my silences. Of what had I ever been afraid? To question or to speak as I believed could have meant pain or death. But we all hurt in so many different ways all the time. And pain will either change or end. Death, on the other hand, is the final silence. I was going to die, if not sooner than later, whether or not I had ever spoken myself. My silences had not protected me. Your silence will not protect you. What are the words you do not yet have? What do you need to say? What are the tyrannies you swallow day by day and attempt to make your own until you will sicken and die of them, still in silence? Perhaps for some of you here today, I am the face of one of your fears, because I am a woman, because I am black, because I am lesbian, because I am myself, a black woman warrior poet doing my work, come to ask you, are you doing yours? Audre Lorde. In the aftermath of the World Trade Center attack, silence was not an option, especially not when, in our community at UConn, racism and mindless warmongering had swooped in the wake of grief and mourning. In the days after September 11th, Muslims and foreigners were physically and verbally harassed, and voices for peace were often harshly silenced. The progressive community on campus rallied and with its allies began working for peace, solidarity, and community at local and global levels. This was not easy work, and I think you all know what I mean. We organized vigils, demonstrations, discussion groups, and solidarity actions using headscarves, t-shirts, and armbands. We worked in spite of sometimes intense pressure brought to bear on us to stop our work, to be silent, to go along with the majority. And I want to honor here the students and staff members who participated in that struggle, who had much more at risk, much more on the line than I did as a professor, because my position affords me a certain degree of protection. Our activist community worked in many ways from a simple principle captured in the slogan, them equals us. And this is one of the t-shirts that we made and wore on campus. That phrase, them equals us, was first used about 15 years ago by AIDS activists who were struggling against the public apathy and prejudice about the AIDS epidemic. The slogan, them equals us, challenged the idea that AIDS was something that happened to them, to other people, like people of color or gay men or drug addicts, people who apparently, in the public mind, didn't deserve compassion and adequate health care. After September 11th, our activist community at UConn began to use the phrase, them equals us, because we needed a way to express the idea of caring and empathy, solidarity and unity. The equal sign is not only an equalizer, it is also a bridge, a connector between people, built of ideas, words, and actions. The equal sign challenges the distancing from other people that is the foundation of racism, the distancing from other people that is the foundation of war and violence. For only those who have so distanced themselves from the rest of humanity could possibly think that the best way to bring peace and freedom to another nation is to bomb its people. And as the anniversary of September 11th approaches and the United States contemplates engaging in yet another war in the Middle East, silence is still not an option. We must still shout out in every way that we can possibly think of that them equals us. For only once we have realized this principle in our communities, our government, and our foreign policy will peace flourish in the world. And only then will I return to my garden in peace. Thank you. Peace.
You have been listening to three speakers who appeared at the Hope Out Loud Peace Rally in Hartford, Connecticut on September 8, 2002. One of the event's chief sponsors was the Connecticut Coalition for Peace and Justice. To contact the coalition, you can call area code 860-523-1534. This special public affairs presentation was produced by George King in the studios of WHUS Radio at the University of Connecticut. Thanks for listening.